Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Andrew Henderson. Andrew is the founder of Nomad Capitalist, a company that helps entrepreneurs and investors reduce their taxes and live a more mobile lifestyle. He's a lifelong entrepreneur who started his first business at the age of 22. And after experiencing the high tax rates in the United States, he began traveling the world in search of more tax-friendly jurisdictions. Over the past 12 years, he has visited over 100 countries and developed a network of trusted professionals who can help people move offshore. Henderson's goal is to help people take back control of their lives and finances. He believed that by planting flags in multiple countries, people can diversify their risks, reduce their taxes, and live a more mobile lifestyle. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
I should also, before we begin, I should also add that I'm going to be attending, speaking at the Nomad Capitalist Conference in September in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia at Andrew's invitation. So I want to thank you for inviting me and I look forward to seeing you in person, catching up over there. But to begin with, tell us more about your business. What is Nomad Capitalist and why did you start it? And why should Bitcoiners care in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. Obviously, a lot of your audience are investors. I think there's a lot of similarities in that you want freedom and you have a lot of control over your life. And so I was in business from a very early age, even like 20 years old, I was starting in business. And I just realized, I mean, when you are different from most people, the things that everyone else wants and follows doesn't work for you. So if you make $20 million from a year in a year in your business, I'm not convinced there's anywhere in the world that's worth $9 or $10 million in taxes. 45-50%. If you make $100,000 and you pay half and you get free healthcare and you get a bunch of other stuff, maybe that's a good deal. But if you're an entrepreneur, if you're an investor, if you've got $20 million in capital gains, why would you stay in a place where they're going to take a huge percentage of that? Are you getting, are you getting what you're paying for? And I think, that's something that people should consider. So what our business does is based on what I've personally done. It wasn't only about saving taxes. It was about wanting better social opportunities, wanting to meet people who better understood me. I think a lot of people in the audience probably understand that. There's people around you that don't get what you're doing. You want to have a community that more understands you. And so it's about lower taxes. It's about more personal freedom. It's about better social connections. And I think you can find that in other places around the world. And I think you can leverage what each country or each place is best at, rather than saying, I'm born in one place. That's where I'll die. That's where I have to keep my money. That's where I have to work. That's where I have to meet my wife or my husband or my whatever. And that's what we help people do. That was my personal journey. And I found how difficult it was. There's multi-jurisdictional planning. The great example we've seen recently is in Dubai. Dubai is no longer tax-free for most businesses. Now they're trying to spin it like, oh, it's a good thing to pay 9% tax. If you want to live there and pay 9% tax, fine. A lot of people didn't live there. They just set up their company there. And now, they're trying to spin that. So, we try and cut through that spin. But we also, Dubai, there's certain kinds of incomes that were never tax friendly. They're actually very untax friendly in a place like the UAE. So it's helping people understand that kind of multi-jurisdictional approach, that it's not as easy as just move to Dubai and all your tax problems goes away. And by the way, we've helped people move to 31 different tax friendly countries. A lot of people prefer Italy or Panama or Malaysia, where our event is. So I think it's understanding that human perspective that I've experienced.
Yes. So can you tell us a little bit more about flag theory and what is it that, why is that a useful framework to think about your business?
Sure. Well, when I started writing about this stuff about 12 years ago, flag theory is very inspirational to me. It's been around for decades. It's the idea initially that you want to have three flags or fly flags. And I think now it should be many more, where if you're born as I was in the United States, you have a U.S. passport in most cases. Maybe one of your parents was born somewhere else and you get that passport. Maybe you have ancestors and that gets passed down. But generally speaking, most people who live in a country, that they're citizens of that country and only that country. So now that country controls you. They live in that country. So that's where they live. They have a job. They have a bank account in that country. They pay taxes in that country because they are tax residents, not because they're citizens, unless you are American. But they're tax residents by virtue of living there. And so kind of everything comes from that one place. And so, okay, well, what if you were a U.S. citizen, but you lived somewhere else? What if you paid taxes somewhere else? What if your company, rather than a U.S. LLC, was a company offshore somewhere? And so you can pretty, arbitrage the best opportunities. I'm a big believer if you have a business, and in some cases, even if you hold crypto in a holding company, you want to have, let's say, a tax-neutral company structure. So you want to have the British Virgin Islands or potentially Hong Kong. It would have up until recently been the UAE free zones or any others like it. There's about 20 different jurisdictions that we potentially work with. For most people, having a tax neutral corporate structure or holding company structure works a lot better. And then you find a jurisdiction that accepts that. So Portugal ended its tax exemption. That's being phased out. But before they did, you could move there and you could pay a very low rate of tax globally. But you couldn't have your company in the British Virgin Islands. You couldn't have it in the UAE. You couldn't have it in Hong Kong because they had a blacklist. Whereas you can go to Italy and you can pay one flat lump sum amount of tax and they don't really have the same blacklist. So if your company's in a zero tax jurisdiction, where can I move with that? So the company probably shouldn't be where you live. You can live in Italy or Ireland or Cyprus or Malta or Panama or again, Malaysia. I mean, there's a lot of places, 31 of them we've helped people with that are tax friendly. That doesn't mean you put your company there. They're tax friendly for individuals who might have businesses somewhere else. And so it's diversifying those things. If you're in Bitcoin, you can live in one place, or maybe you live as I did for many years and you travel the world. You don't live in one place. We have a lot of Bitcoin clients who do that, but they have to have a tax residence somewhere. So they'll go and spend one day or one month, or they'll spend a certain amount of money. They'll get a tax residence somewhere and then they'll not live anywhere full time. And so what you're basically doing is you're saying every place has something to offer. Many people in your audience may not want to have banks, but if you want a bank, I mean, I look at Singapore as the best transactional banking place in the world for those of us who have to, you know, pay bills and receive money in fiat sometimes. So it doesn't mean I want to live in Singapore, right? And when I live in Malaysia part of the year, and I own a property there, and I go down to Singapore and I talk to my banker, oh, are you a Malaysian citizen? Why? Because I live there 3 months a year. Like the average person doesn't understand. You don't always have to live where you're a citizen. So you can be a citizen of any country in the world. There's plenty you can get. Live somewhere else or somewhere else's. Bank somewhere else. Like just have everything diversified to where Singapore is good for this. Do I want to go and pay a 60% tax to buy real estate there? Absolutely not. For what? For 20% marginal increase in quality of life over Malaysia? I think Malaysia is great. In fact, I like the personal freedom that they kind of leave you alone more than they would in Singapore. So that's a plus. So, you know, it's extrapolating what every place is best for.
Yeah. I guess I'll begin by asking, what then is the benefits of dual citizenship? What do you see as the point? I mean, I get the point that you want to domicile your business in a place where you optimize for lowest taxes. I get the point that you want to domicile yourself in a place where you get the lowest taxes. But is it also necessary to get a second passport if your first passport works fine? What are your thoughts on that?
The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifeddin.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the fiat standard and the Bitcoin standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
So there's a couple thoughts. I come from the United States. I gave up U.S. citizenship. Now, because I had a business, I was able to legally pay very, very little, in some years, zero. I had restrictions on how I use the money, but that's not a tax issue. That's just there's restrictions on how you use the money if you want to be American and the structures you have to use, and it was more complicated. But I paid zero tax. They made some adjustments, and that's now a little harder. But I, because I'm pretty international, and other people like me, could probably continue to pay zero tax as a U.S. citizen. If you're in Bitcoin, it's more difficult. Puerto Rico, which is a place we have helped people go, but it's not as interesting to live. People are always trying to find ways to do less than the minimum time you have to spend there. You know, you don't have the same options if you're just an investor in Bitcoin that you do as an entrepreneur. Because as an American, you have to run an active business. And so your options are, if you want to go out and enjoy the personal freedom, the social connections, all the stuff that the world has to offer, that's tough as an American. And so if Puerto Rico is not the place for you, or maybe a handful of other, you know, USVI has some deal, but really Puerto Rico is the place, then you might say, I don't want to be a U.S. citizen. Because depending on how much money I have, I can get a European Union passport for about $1 million in 15 months or so. I can get a Caribbean passport and have decent travel. There's other passports that I can get. And so why do I want to be American? My opinion is, I mean, a country with that much economic heft, they have a lot to lose from Bitcoin success. You'll see some politicians coming out. And I see in the Bitcoin community, yeah, you know, the senator from Wyoming's on our side. I don't think the system is on your side or our side. I mean, it's my side too. I see it as they have something to protect. Malta or Georgia or whatever, They may not all do the right thing, but they have something to gain. They can put themselves on the map. Imagine you were like the blockchain capital of the world because you welcomed all these companies. Or imagine the Bitcoin, like, you know, imagine you did that. You have something to gain. So I've always liked small countries. I think it's especially apropos here. So for the US, you might want to just get out. I think you'll see more countries. I put it out there last year. Australia is inching closer towards this, where they're really particular. If you don't live in Australia, how do you live? Where do you live? What do you do? Do you get paid taxes? I've always surmised Western countries will find a backdoor, maybe not to be as explicit as the US with this citizenship-based taxation. No matter where you live, you have to pay. There's exemptions and a lot of carve-outs for entrepreneurs, not so much so for investors, whether it's in Bitcoin, stocks, options, what have you. But I think other Western countries are going to start, the good passports are going to say, yeah, you know what? If you live somewhere where there's no tax, pay us something. I think you're going to see more of that. And it's starting with countries like Australia really kind of starting to micromanage certain people, where they're going and where they're spending their time. Oh, you don't live the way we think you should live. Oh, that's too tax friendly. Like, that's kind of where it's going. And it's already kind of starting. So that is why I think that a good passport holder needs to be concerned. We saw during COVID, if you're Australian, they wouldn't let you into your own country. So the pact for Western countries that have for so long had the power with their citizens, to me, is gone. I think we finally saw, a lot of people got it through their heads, that you're just kind of like their property. They don't really like value you as an equal partner. They're not there to serve you. They're there to tell you what to do. So I'm glad I had other passports and residences so that I could go places during COVID and I could be comfortable. And I could live my life and I could run my business and I wasn't stuck in limbo. So that helped. And obviously, if you don't have the best passport, then you want another one. But quite frankly, you know, if you're from, let's say, Georgia, we just mentioned that. Georgia's probably not going to follow you if you go to Malaysia, Colombia, what have you. They're not going to take their heavy hand and micromanage you wherever you go. But who knows what can happen in any country. I was married to a woman who, you know, had a Russian passport. I said, you should get some other passports. And she did before it was too late. She got St. Lucian citizenship. She got other citizenships that were in her family tree, that now she's able to travel to Europe and live in Europe at a time when if you're just Russian, you wouldn't. And I said, listen, this Putin is probably going to piss off the wrong person eventually. You're going to want to be prepared for that because there's going to be some pushback. I just think there's so many reasons. You never know what's going to happen. But I think if you're in Bitcoin, it's they're going to want to come and take your money in some way. They're going to try and control you. They're going to try and lock you in. They're going to try and keep you out. And, you know, it's just having more power.
Yeah, obviously having more options just makes it easier to escape whatever dystopian hell is surrounding us. And I think
trying to predict every little thing that could happen, I think is a fool's errand. Have as many options as you can and pivot as needed.
Yeah, I mean, your example of COVID is an excellent example. I think most people for most people, you know, they normalize whatever happens and they just accept it and they move on and they're distracted with other things. But I think for me, what's really startling is that if in January 2020, you got the 100 top geopolitics experts, the 100 top epidemiology and disease and public health experts, and the 100 politicians or congressmen from the US, and you surveyed like a representative sample of all these demographics, say politicians, epidemiologists, doctors, public health officials, geopolitical analysts, and you ask them if there's a bad flu pandemic, or if people get really upset if we say flu, but if there is a bad respiratory illness pandemic, what do you expect would be the most drastic measures that people would take? I don't think 3 out of 100 would have predicted anything as bad as anything that we got. I mean, it was just completely unthinkable in January that they would do something so crazy. Maybe they'll shut down borders with countries that have something like this. But the idea that everyone on earth needs to get locked up in their house, except for Belarus, of course, notable exception. Everybody needs to stay in their house indefinitely until our public health mandarins decide. It's just insane. It was completely unthinkable. And I think you're spot on in that you can't predict what next crazy hell they have in store for us, but you can give yourself more options so that if it does happen, you can get out. And I think, you know, if you found yourself a way to go to a place like Belarus or Sweden in 2020, you would have been out of jail. And I followed pretty closely how things were going in Sweden and Belarus because I was, of course, very curious about it. And I think anybody who was intellectually honest would have been extremely curious about what's going to happen. Because unless we witnessed mass death and devastation in Sweden and Belarus, then it was very clear that all of the insane rituals carried out everywhere else were not about health. And indeed, we did not witness anything extraordinary in Sweden and Belarus. They had similar death rates to every other country surrounding them. It wasn't very different at all over the past few years. So really, you're absolutely correct. Nobody's out there to serve you. Nobody's out there looking out for your interest.
Well, let me, if I can say this, what do they say in a country like the U.S.? Oh, everyone else is making it up. Forget COVID. Is it that there's any other statistics that are good from someone else? It could be economic growth. Oh, they're probably just making it up. Oh, that's a corrupt country. Have you seen what like Nancy Pelosi and all these politicians are doing, buying all the stocks and the options and deep in the money call? Like, that's not corrupt. It's going to cost $2 billion to become elected the president of the United States. That doesn't really, that's, there's no corruption there at all. Singapore, pretty not corrupt. There's countries that are not corrupt, and there's countries that are corrupt, and you can go there and not deal with it. But the idea, this is the problem that I think is so important to touch on, is maybe the U.S. is one of the worst ones at this. People just think, no, we're the best. We've been told that. So everything gets filtered through, we're the best. Really? You had the serendip to be born in the best place in the world at the best, like, that's pretty lucky. And sure, someone has to be lucky. But then they're the best at everything and they never lie and they're not corrupt and all the other countries are corrupt and they all lie. But you really like that, the law of like any kind of, you know, numerical law, would you say that that's just probably not possible? Like your country is just as bad as the rest. And yet the idea is, oh, well, you know, Sweden's probably cooking the books over there, you know?
Yeah. I think this is, I find this a lot when I go to the US. There is a sort of presumption that everywhere else in the world is irredeemably backwards. And I think it's highly flattering for Americans to believe that because there are a lot of things that are terrible about the US. Corruption is one of them, but quality of life in so many ways is absolutely terrible in the US. I mean, the streets aren't safe. The economic aspect of it is, I think, also it's underrated just how terrible services are in the U.S. because my theory of it is that it's since everybody is anybody who develops a certain level of skill quickly graduates to a point where they can get very cheap credit. And then therefore they are incentivized not to care so much about their work because then they switch to the only business model that anybody has, which is interest rate arbitrage. So if you're a good barber shop in the US, you can't just stick to cutting hair properly, which is what made you a good barber shop. Eventually you find a way to borrow money and then you start getting into real estate deals and you start opening up different branches and you forget about cutting hair and you just hire a bunch of noobs who don't know how to cut hair very well and you don't really care. The bad ones will fail. The good ones will go on and start their own interest rate arbitrage business. So that's why, in my mind, it's not very easy to find, to get a good haircut in the U.S. almost always. It's very difficult and it's very expensive. It's my metric of it. And it's just, it's difficult to find this barbershop that you find pretty much everywhere in the world where a guy's just been cutting hair for 25 years. And
right.
That's what he does. And he gets really good at it. It's hard to have that in the U.S. because you have the fiat money printer just providing everybody with an incentive to stop being productive and start being a parasite with interest rate arbitrage.
And then there's no personal connection. So here's what people should know. And if you become successful with Bitcoin and business, whatever, that's where you're starting. So I'm in Bogota, Colombia. I come here for a couple of weeks a year. We have 10% of our team is in this part of Latin America, Colombia, Venezuela, what have you. Brought down our new interim COO. And he's loving it because guess what? He's from Ireland. He has money. He's not going to live in a slum. He's not going to live in the places that you think about Colombia. He's going to live in a beautiful place on the park. He's going to have some of the best food at an incredibly cheaper prices. He smokes. He's going to pay 75% less to smoke because it's not a nanny state. And so he already has that success. And yes, he can go out and get the barber that maybe doesn't cost that much less than in Ireland, but there's going to be a connection. And guess what? He comes here and he's happier everywhere else. Because from the social side, he can meet people, you know, as a guy who's single, he can meet people that are much more interesting. You know, he gets left alone. Things are more affordable. And, you know, I mean, is the U.S. really that safe? I mean, the average person, where they live in the U.S., is it really that much less safe than living in the best neighborhood of Mexico City, the best neighborhood of Bogota? It is less safe statistically than where I'm at in Kuala Lumpur, where our event is at in Kuala Lumpur. I mean, that's just statistically safer. So, yeah, I think that the personal connection piece, you know, we talk about tax. That's what brings people in. People want to pay less tax. But while you're doing it, you're going to realize, especially if you're from the U.S. and probably most Western countries, your life is going to be better off.
Oh, absolutely. And I think Mexico City is safer than most American large cities at this point. I mean, I've been to Mexico City twice recently, and I discussed it with a lot of Americans who all have the same idea, which is in Mexico City, yeah, the crime rate might be high, but it's generally crimes committed by gang members against gang members. And so unless you're dealing drugs or engaged in some nefarious, horrible criminal activities, it's highly unlikely that you're going to end up suffering from crime. Whereas in the U.S., if you look at New York or San Francisco or Chicago these days, I mean, it's just wanton violence everywhere. Nobody is safe. The safest streets in New York, they have homeless people on drugs in the middle of the street. And you never know when they get the wrong kind of hit and then they decide to assault you. And it just happens so often. And I mean, it's sad how a lot of people in the U.S. have normalized this. They think of it as, oh, it's the charm of New York City, only in New York City. No, it's not charming. It's not nice. It's the opposite of the entire point of a city. A city is civilization. It's a place where human beings can be safe next to each other, trading, dealing with one another peacefully. And if you can't have safe streets, you are better off just going back into the jungle. Because of
what do you pay? I paid 43%. I wasn't even in California. I paid 43% all in. When you figure out like Social Security is a cap, you know, Medicare is no cap. You pay federal income tax, progressive. I was at 43. Today I would be higher. Maybe I'd move to Florida or Nevada or something, and that would help a little bit. But what do you get for that? And then meanwhile, I mean,
you get dead kids in Gaza for that. You get dead Iraqis. You get mass murder all over the world.
And for me, it's a big part of why I wanted to leave. And people don't understand, oh, he's just a guy who doesn't want to pay tax. Yeah, you know what? I don't think when you're a successful person, it's ever worth 40 or 50% tax. I don't care if it's the most beautiful place on earth. There's so many good places on earth, which is why I'm always traveling and have more in the past. Because I don't know, there's so many good places. I can't pick one. So if I had to pick one, like I would never, there's just no reason when you're making millions of dollars that anything's worth 40 or 50%. Pay some taxes. I don't think it has to be zero. Happy to pay something, but don't tell me if I'm paying $10 million, I'm the problem. And yes, if you're an American, you have the added bonus. If you go around the world, and I felt this kind of sense of shame, and the people who would push back on that, the ones you're talking about, their identity is being American. They're not independently wealthy because they figured out what you're talking about. They haven't started a business. You know, I see the people that we motivated Nomad Capitalist. That's my identity. My identity is not my passport, other than when I go and show it and people are like, oh yeah, you're the one bombing everyone. Yeah, it doesn't feel good.
No, it does not. And I think it's even ignoring the financial benefit from it, I think the moral case for not paying taxes is far stronger than that. I mean, we're all paying taxes. Unfortunately, if you use the dollar in any case, in any way, then you're holding on the dollar, you're suffering from inflation, and that inflation is going to finance all the horrible criminal things that all of these despicable prostitutes in the U.S. government do around the world. And the only way to opt out, in my opinion, is Bitcoin, and to try and reduce your taxes as much as you can. I think there's definitely a moral case for it. And I find it absolutely pathetic how people pretend like you're, or people act like you're some kind of freeloader or some kind of parasite on society when you refuse to pay 50% of your money so that Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and Donald Trump can go and bomb people, can go subsidize all these criminal regimes all over the world to do this. No, the freeloaders are the ones who are taking part in all of this stuff. The parasites are the ones who live off the taxes.
I met some Yemenis here in Bogota. I've met Syrians. I've had a big presence for a year in Serbia. I've met them. I've met Albanians. I hear the stories. That's what happens when you get out there. Listen, there's probably some ways I've become a little bit less libertarian by being out there and seeing the real world in action outside of where I'm from. But when you see from a geopolitical perspective, when you meet these people, I talked to Yemenis, like, you know, we were never wealthy, but we had, you know, we were doing okay. And then one day, you know, we're on the list. And it's really unfortunate. And when I look at St. Lucia, I'm a St. Lucian citizen, as one of my numerous passports. I look at their prime minister's address, and I guess like on New Year's Eve, and he says, oh, we built a new road. We built a school. You know, Dominique has a passport. They built housing for low-income people. Hey, you can say, you know, the free market should figure that out. But listen, it's an island of fewer than 100,000 people. They get people to invest in citizenship, and they go out and do something for the people. I don't think that the United States is doing that, or Australia is doing that, or the UK is doing that. So I think, I mean, you want to reduce it to the smallest level of government that you can in your life. St. Lucia is the size of like Westlake, Ohio, or a couple suburbs around that where I grew up. And I think, you know, there's more of a stake in that. It's maybe not perfect, but at least you can feel better about it.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I think localism is definitely a huge, huge spanner in the works of statism. It's very hard to imagine somebody like Stalin emerging in a place like St. Lucia. I mean, it's very difficult in all of these small jurisdictions. There's an element of you see people in church on a Sunday and it becomes awkward for them to just throw you in the gulag. You see this over and over again. The smaller the jurisdiction, the less likely government is to do horrible things. And so, yes, as a libertarian, I prefer if things were done on a private market. But I mean, you can even begin to sort of understand why a place like St. Lucia might be closer to a free market in governance, in that anybody can join, anybody can buy the passport, and then that gives essentially the government the ability to monetize its statehood, and then it can spend on people, which might not be ideal from a libertarian perspective, but you know what? It beats spending money on bombing foreigners, and that's, I think, the real benchmark here. It beats spending money on building gulags, and the smaller the government, the less tax revenue it can take from its taxable citizens. The more responsive it has to be, and the more conscious it needs to be of what it does to its citizens. And the fact that people are getting over all of this kind of nationalist brainwashing that comes along with modern nationalism, where you just become emotionally unable to resist the lure of the song and the flag you were inculcated to love as a child. The more people get over that and just realize, no, you know what? I'm not paying half my income to go and bomb foreigners and buy.
You shouldn't pay half for anything, quite frankly. I don't care if you get the most amazing services, because there's someone who will do it for less. And for some reason, this is the one thing people aren't competitive around. They don't shop around. If someone has a coupon for $1 off toilet paper, they go down the street and they buy it from the place where it's $1 cheaper. But when you can get the same services for 80% less, somehow that's bad. And this is why I think if I'm in Bitcoin, and listen, I'm not all in on Bitcoin, but I am in on Bitcoin. I'm not a 100% guy, but I've been in Bitcoin. I mean, the first time was, I guess, late 2013. Stupidly got out and got back in 2017. So for me, I just look at, is a government like the U.S.? I'm sure there's many good Americans, and I'm sure there's probably even some decent people in the U.S. government. But I mean, I look at my channel. There's a guy with his own name who used to work in the State Department who says he's very glad that I can't get my ancestral citizenship from Lithuania to where I can actually feel a connection to a place. I do feel a connection to some of the passports because I have spent time there. But to have a passport that's a part of me in a blood way, American's not blood, to have a passport of my ancestors, I'm glad you didn't get it because what you do is disgusting. Dude, you work at the State Department. You're doing all. He does all the stuff that you talk about. I'm disgusting. And by the way, if you're so happy with your country, couldn't you pretty easily tolerate someone who didn't agree with you? Like, you'd be just so happy. You wouldn't have to argue with anybody. You wouldn't be angry or bitter about it. Do you think that that country is just going to go down without a fight? You know what? They found better money now. So, you know, we're just not going to have as much power. We'll have to live with it. Of course, they're not going to do that. Of course, they're going to tax you into oblivion. They're going to spend billions trying to track everyone's taxes. Listen, I am the goody two shoes of the offshore business. If you want to live in the U.S., they have taxes. No one's forcing you to live there. I don't agree with it at all. But you have 251 other countries and territories you can go to. Go where you're treated best, as I say. I don't encourage anyone to not do what they're supposed to do. I just encourage them to go to a place where the rules align with what they want. Voting is not going to change. You're not going to outvote 300 million people who are heading in the wrong direction, who increasingly think there should be security cameras in your home. Gen Z wants security cameras in your home, like 30% or something, in your home to stop domestic violence. You're going to outvote those people? They want lower taxes. They don't want the Bitcoin guys to be, you know, suckered because they were too, you know, silly to not get into it. Like, are you kidding me? So I just think, you know, this is why you want other passports. And this is why you want other places to live. They're just not going to go down quietly.
Of course. Yeah. And I think the it's telling that the guy who told you this works for the State Department. I think there is a very strong correlation that you will find between that sentiment and getting paid from taxes and from inflation. So if you work for the government,
right? If you don't pay as much, I don't have to. I can't eat. And I guess I think he used to work there. Deep down, she doesn't have any other skills.
Exactly.
I renounce citizenship, and I always say it because I like to give credit where credit's due. The nicest, I would even say, sympathetic people I've ever seen from the U.S. government. So there are some. Listen, you probably don't agree. Extraordinarily pleasant, sympathetic, and helpful, and professional. I'm not trying to paint with a broad brush, but you know, when someone comes out and says that, yeah, I mean, he needs you to pay. Like, there's a conflict of interest. And by the way, there are countries out there like Malaysia, where they have a territorial tax system, and for them, I'm a guy who comes a couple months a year. I wouldn't be a tax resident there anyway because that's a pretty strict days test. You spend 6 months, you're a taxpayer. But even if you're a taxpayer, you don't really pay on foreign income, foreign companies, what have you. Obviously, Bitcoin's a little bit of a sticky widget there. But they're like, hey, and I've been told this, you come and you eat at our nicest restaurants, you buy stuff, you shop in our stores. In some of the countries I go, we hire people, we pay payroll taxes for them, or we have local companies, we pay a little bit of corporate tax through transfer pricing. It's more than what we were going to get. And I think it's a very fair system. Let countries compete. I'm not saying it should be zero. My company pays pretty close to zero, but I have companies around the world that, again, through transfer pricing, we pay a little bit. If they made it totally inhospitable for me to go there, I would just say, I'm not going to be there anymore. And there's a few places we have exited for that reason. So what's wrong with competition? Because there's always going to be somebody in competition who says, yeah, I'll do it for less. That's the spirit of consumer competition. That's how margins go down. It's because someone's willing to do it. One guy does it for 20% margin. Someone else is willing to do it for 14.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Prince Hans Adam of Liechtenstein. Have you read his book, The State in the Third Millennium?
I'm aware of it. I don't think I've read it.
Yeah, I think it's a great book. It's very well worth reading. And it's really eye-opening. It's very rare that you read a book about politics or political theory that offers anything new and thought-provoking. I mean, today, pretty much all political research is very much on board with the ruling religion of democracy and the managerial state. But this guy offers a very stark alternative, and he argues for it very, very convincingly, in my opinion, which is essentially the idea that since the Enlightenment and democratization, politics has been headed toward the direction of giving people more voice in what government does. And that results in more parliamentary participation, more democracy, more voting, and therefore just more involvement and participation in the political process. And that sounds great in principle, but I think what Hans Adam suggests, which I think is very thought-provoking, is that, look, that's not how anything gets done in the world. That's not how Apple works. That's not how Microsoft works. You don't get to vote on who gets to be CEO of Apple as an Apple consumer. You don't get to vote on what they do with the design. They don't even ask you for your feedback. And yet they figure out those things and then they deliver those products that are bought by billions of people all over the world. Why? The reason is you have the right to exit. You can buy their stuff, but you can also choose to not buy their stuff. And simply having that option motivates them to figure out how to do their thing best. And them having full authority over the company without having to take your permission, without having to do politics, without having to try and lobby people in order to get the way what they want, all of that results in them having a very good idea about what they need to do. So this efficiency of the CEO is what he's effectively advocating in as a role for the state in the third millennium, wherein you get more executive authority, you have less voter participation, but in return, you have more of a right of exit. And so you don't have to be a citizen anywhere. You have the right to exit. You have the right to leave. And not just individually, but also collectively, as in small communities. So a village or a town or a city or a province can choose to declare independence, and their right to secession and self-determination should be respected. And I think the world would be a lot better if we stopped obsessing about more democracy, more voting, more team red versus team blue, more my degenerate thief is going to fix things, whereas your degenerate thief is going to ruin things. I think we need to move away from that and just accept that if you have the right to self-determination, then it doesn't really matter who gets into power, because you can just leave, or your jurisdiction could just leave. And I think if you had that right to exit rather than voice, if you could just leave and stop paying taxes to a politician instead of just continuing to cry harder and vote harder and trying to beg them to fix things the way you want, I think you'd get a lot better services and a lot better government in every way imaginable. I think the trash would be collected a lot more efficiently if the people who collect it had to reckon with the fact that you might just leave and hire somebody else, hire another jurisdiction to take care of it. So
this is the problem. But people have said, this is a high compliment I've taken, is you don't get stuck in the nostalgia of the past. Oh, like I talked to my friend in Chicago, we're going to Portillo's. Since he's 12 years old, he goes to Portillo's. Like, it's part of his life. He says, you don't get stuck in that. I worked in the radio business. I grew up around the radio business. It was my father's side hustle. I still enjoy reading about the American radio business. Some of those great radio stations at one point have literally been shut down to tear down the radio towers to build Amazon warehouses. And there was nowhere else to put the radio towers. So they're gone. They're gone forever. I could sit here and be sad and cry. I have friends who still work in the radio business and still own radio stations. And it's tough. Or you can say, you know what, whether I like it or not, this is happening and I can adapt. But the problem is most people get too married to, I like the radio station I grew up with. I like going to Portillo's for a meatball sub. That's the life I want. And then they shut out, you know, there's meatball. I just had a meatball sub the other day here in Bogota. I met my tailor. It's called something new now. Oh, my sandwich, I think. And you can do that. But I think the governments realize, perhaps because they helped create this marketing, this kind of Coca-Cola branding, especially in many Western countries, that, hey, where else are you going to go? Gavin Newsom in California literally said, where else are you going to go? What are you talking about? There's 49 other states. There's Puerto Rico. There's 251 other countries and territories. Where else? What are we living in, the feudal times? That's their attitude. And I think a lot of people, because they've heard that in their entire life, they buy it. And that's why I think the fairest system, if you say, okay, I don't believe in zero tax, the fairest system is some kind of lump sum where you pay your share, that the CEO does a good job running the country. Hey, you want to bomb a country? All right, great. Here's what it costs. I bet a lot of people, if they actually had to pay and not just tell you to pay because you're a rich guy, they'd be like, oh, that's an extra $2,000. That's my share of the bombing. All right, maybe no bombing. We'll wait on the bombing for a while, but it doesn't run that.
Democracy for Iraq can wait.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. So I just think that people have to get over that idea. Even people who I think are libertarians, who are Bitcoiners, who are fans of what we do, will come and tell me, oh yeah, you're in that hellhole down there. It's like, no, but I guess it helps people not get over the nostalgia. And that's why the government has you, because they know most people aren't going to leave.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a lot of propaganda that goes into trying to keep you in that nostalgia and feeling stuck. And I think It's on one side provincialism. It's just people who live in California have never imagined that you can have all of the things that you have in California. You can get them pretty much everywhere in the world, except, you know, for the feces infested streets. I think nobody competes with San Francisco when it comes to that. But pretty much everything you want in California is pretty much available everywhere. And now most of the world is all online. So you can get anything delivered anywhere. The idea that you need to be in California is, I think, ridiculous. It's provincialism, but it's also statism masquerading as provincialism, trying to sell you this kind of emotional attachment that because, hey, you can't leave. No, I can. And I think that's it. More and more people do this. This is why I like to discuss this topic and I like to keep talking about it. I think the more people do it, the better the world will be, not just for you individually, but for everybody. If more people just left their jurisdictions, more governments went bankrupt, more governments would become fiscally responsible, more governments would start learning to not do horrific things to their citizens and start getting better and better at it.
Let's talk about the free market. People say, oh, it must be nice to be a rich guy who had a U.S. passport. And even though you gave it up, you still have the benefits. Well, I actually specifically don't. I don't have one of the world's best passports. Maybe I will someday. But I don't have the benefits of a U.S. passport. And what I learned, yes, I had some good teachers. But I learned from my parents. I learned from my father. I did what he said. There's plenty of people who grew up with me who didn't achieve what I achieved. So obviously, it wasn't the schools. It wasn't being in the United States. Maybe it was how I was raised and what I was taught. But yeah, I think that for me, employing, I just heard 82 people around the world, not a single person's in the United States, not a single person's in Canada, not a single person's in Australia, as a free marketeer and believe that the free market is what will change things. I'll tell you, when we started hiring in, let's just take Serbia. We don't have as much of a presence there anymore, but I started there in 2016. $500, you get some pretty high quality. I mean, English is very widely spoken there. You get some pretty high quality people. Doesn't do it anymore. Now, maybe it's now it's $800 or $1,000. That's still marginally. That's a pretty substantial increase in salary. Why? Well, I meet people in Serbia. Hey, I came here and I'm doing some business here. I heard about it from you, whatever. I mean, that's contributing to the growth of that place. And so if you want to change, now I will in the end benefit from that because again, Malaysia, I live there, our events there 30 years ago, you might not have considered it as strongly, but they've done an incredible job building it. The momentum's heading in the right direction to where now you don't have Amazon, but you have other services. You have consumer conveniences, often better than the US. You have service, it's better. You have all the great restaurants. You can get whatever you want. And so that's changed. That wouldn't have been the case a few decades ago. And so I'm proud of going to places like that and saying, yeah, we're going to hire people and we're going to save some money. It also gives us the chance over time, we can just pay you more. Many of our people have US level salaries because they got there, they earned it. But that's how you enact change. That's how you help other places grow. That's how you lift people out of poverty is you create opportunities and not just say, well, I'm from Ohio, therefore I should only hire Ohioans as if it's my civic duty, right? Really? Here's something I bet some of your audience understands. Part of my childhood was getting mercilessly bullied by people growing up in Ohio. I want to give those people jobs. Like, I talk about it because I want to connect with people and show them there's a way to get over it and not to sit in the anger. If I had to hire them, so be it. But isn't it nice to go somewhere else and create opportunities for folks who need it more? And you're creating a more equal world? You know, I just think that that's the way to save things.
No, I agree with you. What was your thought process getting rid of your U.S. passport? Anything in particular other than, you know, the taxation aspect?
It's really not a motivator because again, I paid zero for all but 1 year, I think, for the years that I was outside of the U.S. I didn't want to go to the U.S. So number one, I didn't want to go to the U.S. I come from a very Protestant family. We're not super close. I talked to my dad. We don't have a big family. So it was never like, hey, you got to come over to, you know, Tia Guadalupe's, you know, picnic every Sunday and that's our thing. I never had that. I didn't want to be in the U.S. I have some friends that are still there. And we talk and we meet up sometimes. They come to me. I just didn't want to be there. I didn't even want to fly through the U.S. It's just so unpleasant. And when you see other countries, even like among Western countries, Ireland, pretty laid back when it comes to like the TSA and immigration, and like just, you don't even have to go to an emerging world country to find a place that's much more hands-off. So I just didn't want to be there. I felt uncomfortable going there. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall. My parents, my father in particular, have been telling me this since I was a kid. The U.S. is changing. It's going in the wrong direction. The people are going to become angrier and angrier because there's going to be more opportunities for folks overseas. And then I'm not anti-Trump. Let me just be very clear, because there's no nuance on the internet. I'm sure there's plenty of things Trump and I agree on. And I guess, yes, America first, fine. Put your country first. Stop subsidizing Germany so they can use their high taxes to pay for social services and yours go to pay for the wars. Although I think the U.S. kind of likes the wars more than Germany. But anyway, I'm sure Trump and I can agree on some things. But here's how I interpret the subject of America first, and it turns out I was right to some extent. If you don't live in our country and you're a citizen, like, you're doing the wrong thing. And there were elements of that, and there were policies that came out, and I think there are still under Biden as well, where if you're American, come here or you're a nasty traitor. And that was never going to be me. I didn't want to live in the country. Again, like my wife, imagine like trying to live with a Russian wife these days, like in the United States, probably wouldn't go so well. Probably would be difficult in the first place just to even get in. I just said I don't want to be there. I don't feel good traveling with a passport. I have no problems traveling anywhere. I did get invited to speak in Canada recently. I said, okay, I'll have to get a visa. You know, it's not worth $40,000 for me to get a visa. I don't want to go to Canada. So the few places I can't go that I could have gone as an American, I don't want to go. It's almost like it's a forced limiting options plan. And so I got the geopolitics benefit. I got, yes, easier accounting. I've got a complicated business structure that would have probably cost me $50,000 and a lot of headache and hassle to do it for. I got rid of the anxiety of what if I report one bank account or one property wrong on this form, and maybe they don't like my videos and they'll do something terrible to me. Like, there's not a lot of forgiveness in the U.S. compared to other countries. All those things together, I don't like the vibe of the country. And it doesn't mean, listen, if people like it, that's for them. That's cool. I'm out. I don't have to be upset about it, but you asked me. And so I wanted to get away from all that. And the benefit that I realized pretty quickly was, yeah, I have better control over the money in my business. So I can spend that on things that I want. And that's why I have homes around the world. And I stepped up that once I left the U.S. because I could access more of the money that I made. But I just fundamentally don't agree with what they do. And I just saw the writing on the wall that this is only going to get worse, because the U.S. is not going to become a wealthier country. I mean, marginally, yes, but on an adjusted basis against all the other countries, no. And Steve Bannon said, we hollowed at the middle class here and we built one in Asia. As someone who spends a lot of time in Asia, I'm happy people in Asia who are very nice people in some place, Malaysia, some of the most beautiful people you'll ever meet. I'm glad they have a chance. Why should just Americans have a chance to get rich? Like, how dare, like, if you think that, you're kind of a bad person. Like, I need a 3-car garage and 3 cars and a 5-bedroom house and only one of us should work. So that, like, but, you know, only if Malaysians starve to death, like, that's not a good thing to think. And that's kind of how the world worked in the mid 20th century. So, is this hollowed out middle class, which I'm not celebrating. I'm celebrating the new middle class in other places. I'm not celebrating people's failure, people's demise, but it's happened, the result. There's more equality now across countries. Do you think that, you know, that's not going to lead to policies of some rich guy living outside of the United States who's worked very hard his entire life and thinks he's earned everything? Are they going to come after you? I think they will. Why do I want to wait around and see?
Yeah, I agree with you. I've considered moving to the U.S., and I think there are a lot of problems with living there at this point. I mean, the life in the cities there is very, very bad. Security is a major issue, and trying to have a social life for your kids is extremely difficult given all the insane ideologies that are being shoved down everybody's throat. And there's a very, very strong totalitarian streak there. In a sense, people just believe that what America stands for is freedom, and you have to be forced to be free. And freedom for us is whatever the current thing is, whatever the CNN and the intelligence agencies behind it tell us we need to be getting worked up about is what you should be getting worked up about. And I think it's highly unhealthy place. And I think primarily though, I think the biggest case against America is if you're a Bitcoiner, I jokingly usually say that one of the best hacks to using Bitcoin properly is to just not be an American. I think if you're not an American, if you don't live in America, you've spared yourself from an enormous number of possible problems. Because as you said, I don't think other countries are going to be as aggressive in going after Bitcoin. Who knows? I mean, I can see the case for why they might go after it. And yet, I still think it's something that we've had Bitcoin running for 15 years and they still haven't gone after it in any kind of meaningful sense. And I think, you know, people like me have written entire books about why Bitcoin can replace the dollar and why I think it is likely. It's not exactly a secret conspiracy out there where we're marketing Bitcoin as some kind of innocuous software that's then going to one day jump and replace the dollar. It's pretty open, but I think the main security feature in Bitcoin continues to be the power of economic incentives. The reason I think people might not fight it is because they are going to want to join it and they're going to realize joining it is more lucrative than fighting it. So this might not materialize, but still, I think being in the US, as you said, opens you up to all kinds of problems in that regard, which might materialize. I hope they don't. I'm not saying they will, but I think
we can't hope though. You can't live a life on hope.
Exactly.
Pick one point on what you said, and maybe a question is: Americans will go to like Niagara Falls, or they'll go to London, and they'll say there's nowhere else to go. They're not going to. I remember a guy said once in like Tanzania. He's like, "You think anyone's bothering you in Tanzania?" Like, and then they say, "Oh, African passport." I'm not saying move to Africa. Listen, I'd have an African Union passport just as a call option on increasing African unification, that you could live anywhere, kind of like the European Union. And some of those countries are going to be more free and some are going to develop. And the African middle class is growing. That's not my first, second passport. But, you know, the idea of there's nowhere to go, people say, and I'm wondering what you think about this, if the US falls, the entire world will fall. There's that kind of like this arrogance that, you know, the US without being successful, like everyone else will collapse with it. And I push back on that.
No, I disagree entirely. I think the world is really moving away from the US. I think it'll be the collapse of the dollar would be devastating for a lot of people around the world because a lot of people are holding on to dollars and a lot of central banks have a lot of reserves in US dollars. But if you look at the world in the last 15 years, particularly since 2008, central banks have started hedging their exposure to the dollar by increasing their allocation to gold and other hard assets. So you see, the Chinese central bank has accumulated enormous amounts of gold in the last 15 years. So has Russia. So has Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia is probably not that enormous. But beyond just gold, they're also accumulating hard assets. And so you're seeing all these sovereign wealth funds and all these central banks and all these state investment agencies, which in a simpler world in which the US was more tolerable and the US outlook was a lot more bullish, you would see these people stacking on treasuries, essentially, because treasuries really are the best reserve asset in the fiat world because it's the world's most liquid market. It's a $25 trillion market. And so it makes sense for you to hold that as your reserve asset. But you see in the last 15 years, people are trying their best to find alternatives. And so you have investment in infrastructure. People are buying seaports all over the world. People are buying natural resources, mines. Chinese investment authorities are investing in building up seaports all over Africa and Latin America, all over the world. And so you can, obviously the Americans look at that as being awful, evil colonialism, imperialism. Suddenly you start getting all Americans sounding like leftist anti-colonialists when any interaction between Chinese and Africans is considered to be evil colonialism. When I can't help but notice the extreme lack of death and destruction visited upon Africa, Asia, and the rest of the world by the Chinese military over the past 50 years, you know, while the US is providing billions of dollars of weapon to the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza just locked up in a cage and being shot at and bombed with billions of dollars of weapons. China isn't doing things like that. China's investing. And these Americans freak out and they present it as if it's Soviet. Oh, they're buying the seaports.
They push back. They push back. And Nigel Farage is speaking at the event, and he said this. And I like Nigel a lot. He's been a really stand-up guy. But we interviewed him a couple of years ago. He said, why should countries choose the U.S. and the U.K. over China? He said, we have shared values. And what China's saying is, well, we don't have to share your values. We just want to invest. And so it's interesting with everyone kind of, you know, the libertarian side pushing back on stuff like ESG. I have my own personal kind of principles of what I want to invest in. I don't invest in Raytheon. I wouldn't invest in that. There's a company in Singapore, great company on paper. I don't want to invest in what they do. They help the police come and screw with you. I'm out. I'm out on that. But like maybe we should let people, you know, do their own thing and like not have to apply our values to everybody else. And like generally speaking, that's a little kind of an indication that you don't really believe in your values that much, that you have to thrust them on people. But yeah, that's the thing. China, they're not a part of our values.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it was some African official who said it when the Americans come, yep, they give us lectures. When the Chinese come, they give us investment. They're building a seaport. They're not trying to teach your kids about all of the latest fashions in sexual deviance that they need to learn at age of six in the U.S.
By the way, did you see the former president of Honduras? I remember, I guess he just got convicted. I think like 10 days out of office, he was arrested by the U.S. for like drug trafficking. And I'm thinking to myself, first of all, the drug trafficking going through Central America, because it used to go by plane. You guys shut that down. You guys, the consumers of the drugs, not the Hondurans, the Salvadorians, the Colombians. I mean, obviously some of them do, but the drugs are going to the U.S. Does anyone really think that the U.S. wasn't involved with that guy? And then once he was no longer useful, he's a drug trafficker. We have to bring him to justice. I mean, it's so hypocritical.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, the CIA's record in drug trafficking is incredible. But on this issue of values, I think most people don't have the self-awareness or intelligence to realize that when you're dealing with other people, you have to be aware that they don't take your words at face value. They look at your actions. And so if you're a brainwashed American who believes their government is better than a bunch of mass murdering sociopaths and thieves, you believe in the propaganda that they give you, and it's hammered down your throat all your life. You watch your TV, you go to school, they're all about how America's the land of the free, America's good, America's out there doing good in the world. But for people who grow up in the rest of the world who don't get that propaganda rammed down their throat, it's very easy for them to see that, yeah, this is all bullshit. This is all marketing material. It's a bad advertisement. That's not what American values are. American values is a cover, are a cover for what essentially is a government that is out of control. It has infinite money because it can print money. It has infinite weapons. And it is up for being commandeered by anybody. Anybody can commandeer to pursue all kinds of deranged and criminal purposes, and it can be commandeered very easily. So, I mean, you know, Palestine and Israel is one obvious case of that, and the whole world watches as people are literally being starved to death, and the weapons are being given by the U.S., and the U.S. is unable to do anything about it, while going around and lecturing people on how they should do everything. You know, they're out there lecturing people on sexuality. They're out there lecturing people on how to run their lives, how the family should exist, all sort of social values that are being pummeled down the world's throat by the State Department and all these NGOs and all these government-related entities all over the world and USAID and all that stuff. That's what people think of as your values. Your values is just a military-industrial complex gone out of control. It's ready.
Right. We get to choose our actions. We don't get to choose how people respond to our actions. And people, just in any kind of situation, don't like that reality. They want to act one way and then get credit for, like, they want to be a nice, everyone wants to be a nice person. I'd like to be a kind person, not a nice person. But I am curious, because here's what people say to me. They say, well, then why is everyone trying to come here? Now, I see this, and I go to Malaysia. 99% of Malaysians don't want to leave. They like it. They have a good system. They love their country. They're happy there. They get left alone. Like they don't want to leave. The ones that do, they go to the UK, they study, they come back and they practice at Prince Court Hospital, one of the best hospitals in the world. Some people who move, they want to go to Germany. They want to go to Ireland. They want to go to wherever. The majority are not going to the US, but what is your response to the person? And then you see like numbers of Mexico. It's like net migration is actually flipped where people want to stay in Mexico. What do you say though? I'm curious. To the people, well, if it's so bad, then why is everyone coming here? Because my answer is, if you're a successful person, you're not moving to the U.S. by and large. I mean, a few, but by and large, it's people who want economic opportunity.
Absolutely. I think this is cope in a sense, in that the kind of people that are really eager to move to the U.S. and Canada are primarily, I would say, people who are interested in benefiting from the welfare state. And so I remember at a certain point in time, I considered moving to the U.S. I considered moving to Canada. And I remember looking at just the math of it. And it's just insane, as you said, you know, the amount of taxes that you pay. And I had a friend who was in a similar situation. He's not a friend. His wife is friends with my wife. And they were considering immigrating. And he doesn't really work. He's not a very productive person. And for him, that was the lottery thing. This is the kind of person who's really eager to go there because he, you know, for me, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, damn, that's going to be a lot of taxes. Is it really worth it? Is it not worth it? For him, it's an entirely different calculus. And the calculus is, wow, that's going to be a lot of free money. I don't have to worry about feeding my kid anymore because they're going to be babying before my kid. I don't have to worry about schooling. There's going to be free schooling. I don't have to worry about continuing to eat sugar and getting fat because then I could just go to socialized medicine. So if that's what you're after, then yeah, you see a lot of people are eager about that.
And until they have no more money left and they can't pay for your socialized medicine anymore. They're like, oh, you had too much sugar, so you're out.
Yeah. Now, I mean, obviously, I'm painting with a very broad brush. There are a lot of highly accomplished people who are moving there, but I think it's not as much as people like to think, because you can get your startup off the ground without having to move to the U.S. You can get investors from the U.S. without having to go to live in the U.S. And so I still think obviously there is so one thing I'd say is the welfare state and that they're attracting the wrong kind of people. And the other thing, of course, is that there is a money printer in the U.S. The U.S. is the only country in the world that can print its own money and ship it off to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world would lap it up and buy it. And so that means there are enormous opportunities for making money there. There are enormous opportunities for rent seeking, and there are enormous opportunities for you to enter into some kind of organization that is related to that, that allows you to become pretty rich. And so there's a lot of VC capital as well. There's a lot of investment. So of course, you know, money is a significant thing, but I think increasingly as you demonstrate, and I think as we see in the sovereign individual thesis, we're seeing less and less draw for the richer countries. I think the world now is very different from what it was 40 years ago. In 1980, yeah, you were a lot more Malaysians, I would guess, who would have wanted to migrate to the US or Europe in 1980 than they do in 2020, I think.
I think Malaysia is such a great, I think that people there, there's a simplicity to life in places like that, which I will probably never accomplish. But I think there's enough people there that they just like that. And listen, they built something that was great. Yeah, I think that, you know, for me, we just got a call. We get calls every once in a while. I'm not saying it's that many, but we got a call the other day. Hey, do you want to sell part of your company? And I thought to myself, I guess there was a moment, not, you know, a while back where I'm like, well, is that an option? But now I say to myself, either sell the whole thing, which I wouldn't do now, or you're just going to basically be a guy who's reporting to this minority shareholder who put in a bunch of money. Or if you get VC funding, now you're reporting to them. I mean, to me, the premise of Bitcoin aligns with what I'm about, even outside of Bitcoin, in that I would rather have the highest percentage of building something that I own and I control and I love. I don't want some guy telling me how to run it. You know, I brought in people who are more experienced than I am in my business at doing certain things. There are more processes and it is a little bit less avant-garde than I just when I did it on my own. But it's still the values are there, the culture's there, the goals are there. Imagine having, you know, to go to the US and take VC money or selling out to some guy in the US. And I think a lot of people don't understand some of these guys are real soul-sucking investors. I mean, they just want to destroy your company. It's about selling the tables and chairs. There's no vision. There's no goal. And so if you're someone who wants to build something and make an impact, to me, that takes away an extra layer of being in the U.S. because you can start a business anywhere. And I'm really proud. And we've had clients, you know, Egyptian guys, $10 million and Moroccans and Brazilians and Vietnamese, you know, $5, $10, $100 million net worths. They built something from scratch and they didn't have to go to the U.S. In fact, they may not even be welcome in the U.S. because the U.S. is judgmental. You're from Egypt. We don't care if you have $50 million. I mean, in many cases, they'll still let you in. But some of them, we don't like this about you. I don't know why you'd want to be in that system. So I guess if you want to go and you want to raise money, those are some of the hardest clients for us because they can't, they have to have the Delaware C Corp. They have to be there. They have to meet people every month in California, whatever it is. That doesn't sound like the kind of freedom that I wanted as an entrepreneur. And the idea that like, I'd rather have an 80% chance at getting $50 million, for example, which is just a random number because I built it myself over time, than having some, you know, WeWork-esque 1% chance at hitting it big and having to answer some VC all the time. That just sounds kind of against the principles of anyone who believes in anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. I wanted to ask you about Bitcoin. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin and the nomad capitalist lifestyle? How does it help you? And what do you recommend to your clients? What are your thoughts on what people should, how do you use it?
I mean, we're not financial advisors, so we don't advise whether people should buy Bitcoin. People come to us with Bitcoin. They come to us with all sorts of different situations. I encourage people on that front to do what they want. I do say this. I like a little bit of diversification, even if it's lifestyle real estate. I understand, you know, you don't want to cash out at a low. But for me, my principle just in life is I'm not always waiting to cash out at the all-time high. My perspective is you want to take a few percentage points off the table. It could be 1, 3, 5, 10 and get a second passport. I like having lifestyle real estate. It's a form of asset protection. It's a form of, I think, lifestyle improvement. Having homes in different places around the world, it can sometimes lead to residence permits and or passports. So like Turkey, for example, buy a property, get a passport. The prices on those generally go up or the programs go away. So that's my thought on Bitcoin is if you're all in on it, be all in on it. But I would want to have other assets that insure, like as an insurance policy and as a lifestyle policy on the main value of that main asset. So people have Bitcoin. Obviously, if they want banks, we deal with them on finding banks that are friendly to that. We're seeing more. You know, DBS in Singapore has come out and said they want to be very friendly in terms of the crypto space. I understand it's a little bit different. So you're seeing more. You know, obviously, if you have crypto, there's certain passports that are easier to get in terms of proof of wealth, depending on what percentage of assets is in Bitcoin. So these are the kinds of things we think about. I don't tell people what to invest in. Other than I think most people we have these days have some Bitcoin. My only thought is if it's 100%, I don't want to be 100% in anything. So I just think it on a lifestyle level and on an insurance level, especially if you're a citizen of a country that's just not going to be happy with the progression of Bitcoin. You know, you can say, hey, Bitcoin's at $65,000. I don't want to sell. It's going to go to a million. Well, by the time it goes to a million, you're going to have so much more press. It's going to be talked about. I mean, look at what happened back in 2021. I mean, everything on CNBC was Bitcoin. And then it kind of waned. What happens when it goes to $1 million? Number one, you're going to have more people adopting it who don't agree with you. My father and I, we got the internet. We had Prodigy Internet in 1994. And it was very libertarian. My father said, yeah, once this gets adopted, it won't be libertarian anymore. It'll be everybody. The average person is not a libertarian, so it'll be ruined. But back then it was. So the libertarianism streak in Bitcoin, as you have greater adoption, you're going to have more calls for whatever some of the stuff you didn't want is. And that's going to be in the picture. It's going to be $1 million Bitcoin. Like that's going to be news. You think that like no tax agency or no this or no that's going to like pay notice of that. So the idea, and this is the part about the person who moves to, you know, somewhere just hoping to get some free money and not thinking down like what happens when the free money runs out because we took too much free money. If you're thinking long term and Bitcoin, you know, goes 20x, what else is going to happen? I don't think that they're just going to sit there. The U.S. Senate, oh, that's okay. You know, they're going to do something. And so if you don't do something because you're all in because you want to keep all of that Bitcoin to 20x, you're going to wish you'd taken 5% and gotten some kind of insurance policy to protect the other 95%, which is still going to go up by whatever it is. Like, so the idea is, especially as they become more successful, You know, you're not always going to optimize for opportunity cost. Do as much as possible, but make sure you're covered. That's my thought.
Yeah, I think these are wise words. And it's pains me to say it, but I mean, obviously, for us convicted full-time Bitcoiners, it's very easy to get carried away and not keep in mind these other scenarios. And I think both these massive crashes that we've had, which I believe we're going to probably still have again, every cycle when Bitcoin goes up, people start saying, this is it. There's not going to be another crash. I think it's too early. I think we're still going to get a crash. And so whether it's these crashes or it's political problems, I think I must painfully admit that there might be a case for selling some of your Bitcoin at a certain point and diversifying into other assets, even though I still think Bitcoin is best. But I mean, diversification in a sense allows you to protect against some of the risks that Bitcoin concentrates.
If someone wants to come, people always ask, we have the event, Nomad Capitalist Live. We have a service. People for years have asked us. That was how I got the Bitcoin the first time in December of 2013. The guy said, will you take, it's 2.5 Bitcoin to come to our very first event. It was called something different. And we got 2.5 Bitcoin. It was worth like $800, $2,000 back then. If you believe in it, I mean, you have a job or you have some other, like, spend that money, I would guess. I mean, I think that's what a lot of people tell me. But there's still people saying, hey, can I pay with Bitcoin? I mean, to me, how you pay is irrelevant to me. I just think that if you believe in a revolutionary event taking place in terms of, in this case, financially, the idea that in revolutions, people just lay down and, okay, great, like we lost. Really? No, you want to be prepared for that. And I think that what's maybe made me successful, I don't think I'm that smart in a sense. And I always think, hey, this could fall apart tomorrow. And what would I do like to prepare for that? I think more people should have that attitude. Like, what if it all fell apart tomorrow? Or what if there's something that I'm missing? What would I do? And that's generally served me pretty well. Not at all being arrogant about it.
Yeah, I think that kind of contingency planning is highly, highly valuable in life. Okay, well, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for your time. We've taken longer than we had agreed to, so I thank you for your generosity. This has been enormously useful and helpful, and I hope more of our listeners check out your work. And if you're in Kuala Lumpur or around somewhere close to Kuala Lumpur, a flight from Kuala Lumpur, join us September 25, right? September 25th.
September 25th through September 28th, plus we're doing a VIP day on the 29th. In Kuala Lumpur, about 40% of the people last year were from North America. So we get the best North Americans because they really want to come and learn about what we're talking about. But I'm following a lead, and I love what you're talking about because we have more speakers this year. We've got a guy from South Africa. We've got the CEO of AirAsia from Malaysia. The guy built one of the biggest airlines from it. I thought it was $1 million he invested. Now I'm told it was one ringgit he paid to take it off the government's hands. And now it's this huge, amazing venture. Let's hear what he did. Like, I'd love to have Americans, and we have still a lot of them coming, Canadians. But let's hear what the guy in Malaysia did to become, you know, to build billions of dollars of wealth. Let's hear what the guy in South Africa is doing. Let's hear what you're doing. Nomad Capitalist is not about getting out of the U.S. It's about optimizing for all the problems that are out there and going somewhere, running to something, not running from something. I think it's easy to try and run from something. Now that I see all the opportunities out there, it's easy to run to them. So that's what we're talking about. But the answer to your question is September 25th through 28th this year. And we're excited to have you.
Yes, and I'm very happy to be there. I look forward to seeing you and meeting you in person for the first time. Thank you so much for the invite, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers. Take care.